Here on Gadget Lab, we dive deep into the tech universe, tackling questions like, is giving companies access to your genetic material a good idea? And are the latest phone releases really that different than the last ones? We want to help you make informed decisions about what is worth your attention. And here's something that is undeniably worth your time, a digital subscription to Wired. Lucky for you, we are giving Gadget Lab listeners an exclusive discount, 20% off an annual subscription to Wired. Just visit wired.com and use the promo code GL20 to get 20% off a digital subscription. Use GL20 to get exclusive access to stories on the latest innovations like AI, deepfakes, and VR, as well as today's most talked about people in technology.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Greetings, technology fans. Michael here. Gadget Lab is off this week, but we have a special pinch hit surprise for you. We're going to play you an episode of Wired's other podcast, Have a Nice Future. You'll recognize one of the voices on the show because one of the hosts is our very own Lauren Good. The other is our boss, Wired's editor-in-chief, Gideon Litchfield. The episode you're going to hear is a conversation with Noah Rafford, the former futurist-in-chief at the United Arab Emirates Dubai Future Foundation. His whole job was predicting the future, like he is a professional soothsayer on topics like technology, transportation, and the climate. As you can imagine, he says we have a pretty bumpy road ahead of us, so we'd better buckle up. Enjoy this episode of Have a Nice Future, and we'll be back next week with our regular episodes of Gadget Lab.
I always feel, hey, hi. 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Lauren Good.
And I'm Gideon Litchfield, and this is Have a Nice Future, a show about how fast everything is changing.
I want to help you.
Each week, we talk to somebody with a big, audacious idea about the future and ask, is this really the future we want?
Doc.
This week, our guest is Noah Rafford.
I'm from the future.
Who for nearly 15 years served as an in-house futurist for the government of the UAE.
All right, I'm going to ask the question that everyone's wondering about. What is a futurist? Is this a real job?
Well, I mean, I think some people imagine it's just, you know, a guy who sits around making predictions about the future. And there are probably some people who do just that. But Noah calls himself an applied futurist, by which he means that he studies trends, technological, economic, demographic, political, you name it. And then he works within institutions like the government to help them take those trends into account in their decision-making and their policies. So how should they think about the impact of AI, for instance?
I was having a conversation with a Ghanaian friend recently, and the potential for AI and all the tools which represent in that kind of larger space has for basically dysfunctional failed states and second-order semi-functional states, which is most of the world in some argument, is absolutely huge.
All right, so he sounds pretty positive on AI, but we don't actually know how that's going to shake out yet. I'm wondering if you two talked about things he has predicted accurately in the past or some things he got right.
I mean, he made a pretty good call on COVID.
Called that early. I stopped going into work 2 months before it became a commonly accepted thing. When I had to go into work, I was wearing masks and everyone was yelling at me like, you're freaking people out. Why are you doing this?
And of course, we talked about climate change.
We still labor under the belief that we can stop climate change. And that's just not true.
Huh. That's pretty jarring to hear. What are we supposed to do with that kind of information?
Well, I think there was this undercurrent to the conversation with Noah, which was that being a futurist is not just about predicting the future or even about working with governments or other institutions to capitalize on it, but it's about being ready for it emotionally. Noah is kind of like a future therapist.
I can see you're really upset about this. You ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill, and think things over.
Well, therapy typically leaves me feeling a little drained and like maybe I need 3 days to process whatever was discussed. So I look forward to hearing your conversation with Noah, and then maybe you and I can cry together afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, we may cry, but I think you'll feel somewhat uplifted because even though he says some really alarming things, I think Noah takes the premise of the show and kind of flips it on its head. For him, the question isn't, is this the future we want? It's more, how do we get ready for the future that's coming, both technically and emotionally? That conversation with Noah Rafford is after the break.
This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Each episode features insight you won't find anywhere else from the center of the conversation surrounding emerging technologies like AI. Right now on the podcast, you can hear a special episode where Brad Smith lays out Microsoft's vision for a vibrant marketplace driving the new AI economy. To hear more, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
Noah, thanks for joining me on Have a Nice Future. Are you having a nice future?
I'm having a great future.
Well, I would kind of expect a futurist to be having a great future. But this future that's coming, it's climate change, it's AI, it's floundering democracies. As you readily admit, it's pretty scary. So how do we prepare for that?
Yeah, there's a cognitive fallacy, which I like to use, called the futurological materialism trap. And it comes from an old book on Buddhism called Spiritual Materialism, right? The idea that if you just meditate enough, you're going to achieve enlightenment, and that enlightenment is an escape from suffering. And if you dig deeply into Buddhism and my spiritual traditions, is not the case. You know, you can't, enlightenment is not the alleviation of suffering, nor is analysis the alleviation of uncertainty about the future. The futurological materialism fallacy states that there is a certain amount of data which you can analyze, and that if you just think about the right thing, if you pay attention to the right thing, you won't get surprised or you'll find the advantage. And that's an illusion. That's a trap, because there is no right thing. Everything is falling apart at once. Everything is changing simultaneously. And there's no amount of data you can analyze. There's no amount of trends which you can research or time which you can spend to actually discover what's going to really happen in the future. You just end up stressing yourself out and missing the real changes which are happening around you because you don't know what to prioritize, and you spend all your time in this analysis paralysis.
I see. That's a lovely parallel. I like that a lot. And I think it's kind of reassuring to understand that we can spend time thinking and we don't have to find the answer. That doesn't mean that we've done a bad job.
That's precisely right. Then that opens to the question of, well, what can you do? If it's not a question of data collection and of analysis, then what is the right response to have here? What is a healthy emotional response to the terror of the future and the excitement of the opportunities presented to us? And really, that gets down to something which has nothing to do with analysis or even thinking. That's a much more of an emotional response to the actions which we are able to take in our lives, be they large or small. And a funny application of this is when it comes to climate change. Like, objectively, it is materially irrelevant if you recycle or not. Objectively, it is absolutely irrelevant to the course of this planet if you use plastic straws or not, right? It makes zero difference to the outcome of climate change. However, subjectively, that might be an action which you can take consciously, which makes you feel better about being aware of this issue and trying to gain some power over that huge, terrifying issue in your life through small actions. And that's important because the key thing here when you face this terror of the future is for us to be able to translate that terror into excitement and opportunity is we have to feel some sense of agency. And the only way to feel agency is through action, small, medium, and large.
So taking action is more important than whether it's the right action, the perfect action to take. The most important is to have agency and do something. What are one or two things that you think are important, pretty likely future trends that most people are not paying enough attention to? Maybe one that's scary and one that's positive.
Well, my go-to answer for this historically has been climate change and AI. Thankfully, we're becoming more and more aware of the reality of the climate change, but we still labor under the belief that we can stop climate change. And that's just not true. We cannot. Like the damage has been done. We might be able to lessen the consequences of it, but ultimately our entire lives, and certainly our children's entire lives, are going to be spent dealing with the consequences of climate change. And that's going to produce dramatic, extraordinary, historic shifts in all areas of our lives, which even those of us who do this on a day-to-day basis have a hard time really emotionally accepting, right? You know, we're likely to see a billion plus climate refugees in our lifetime, which is going to drive state failure, border clashes, xenophobia, racism, currency collapse, the collapse of electricity grids, food stresses, more pandemics, right? That's a terrifying thing to really live with. About once or twice a year, I have a conversation with my children that, you know, we're pretty lucky, but it's a pretty high likelihood that we're going to be refugees at some point in our life.
That's quite a lot to set them up for.
It's quite a lot. And what's been interesting about this in terms of both parenting, but how you or all of us deal with these sorts of scary big changes over time, is when you first have that conversation, it's terrifying and you ignore it or you deny it. And the second time, you accept a little bit more. And the third time, it's scary, but you're able to sit with that fear a little bit more. And the fourth and the fifth and the sixth time. So by having this conversation every 6 months, over time for years and years and years, you get to this point that is normalizing an emotional experience of dramatic change. And it shifts from being a terrifying, life-ending horror show into something which is just like, okay, yeah, if it happens, what would we do? Where would we go? How would you adapt? What might be exciting about this? Who would you want to spend time with? Where would, you know, these sorts of things. It becomes more proactive because you're gradually taking away the terror and the emotional pain of our comfortable lives being ripped away from us and therefore preparing for a more exciting future.
What's something that's coming up that you think we should be excited by instead of terrified by?
Right. So that's the terrifying question. And again, my traditional go-to answer here has been AI, but which was something which very few people outside of the field were paying attention to until about, I don't know, 2 months ago when GPT-3 came out.
Okay, so like now everybody knows about GPT and its variants, but you're also seeing people warning about use cases like, you know, someone can just use it to cook up any number of recipes for toxins and how to distribute them, or, you know, and all sorts of possibilities for mischief that just now become much easier. So what makes you confident that it's net positive rather than negative?
But the thing that excites me about that is because unlike most other emerging technologies to date, the degree of public discourse around the risks is exceedingly high. You know, like my father, who is quite intelligent, but pretty elderly at this point, not quite engaged in these issues, is forwarding me articles about OpenAI's discussion of the risks of this for misinformation and for using this for toxic chemicals and these types of things. So the degree of public awareness of this and the degree of conversation in the public realm about the risks and opportunities is really quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinarily sophisticated. And it's just the tip of the iceberg here. We're going to see all sorts of regulatory experimentation around this soon as people struggle to deal with the copyright implications and the cross-border jurisdictional issues of these things and the issue of IP if you upload a document that is, you know, under NDA or medical data to one of these services, then who owns that? Where does that go? Have you breached HEPA terms? All this stuff is really materially present right now and is being debated in every industry right now at a very advanced level. And that gives me hope.
There was this survey of 700-something AI experts that has been making the rounds that asked them if they thought that, you know, what was the likelihood basically of AI leading to human extinction or serious human incapacitation of the human race as a civilization, words to that effect. And 50% of these experts said they thought there was a more than 10% chance. Isn't that a pretty scary number?
I think it is pretty scary, but I also think that's a pretty honest assessment of the existential risks that we face, not just with AI, but really in terms of climate, in terms of nuclear exchange, in terms of additional pandemics, in terms of the total collapse of the financial system. You know, I think that part of being sort of future savvy in today's world is looking clear-eyed at the real terrible potentials of these technologies and not just turning your back on them like a bad parent who doesn't want to have anything to do with the world their children is living in, right? But actually really engaging in these questions. Now, is 10% too high? Does that mean we shouldn't try to explore the implications and benefits of this? I would argue no.
Does it mean, though, we should slow down the deployment of it, maybe?
Is that even possible?
That's a fair question.
Yeah.
But it certainly makes the case that I think that you're making, which is that we should be talking about this a hell of a lot more.
Absolutely. And that's my fundamental point when it comes to AI. The thing that is encouraging about that is that, unlike, you know, greenhouse gases or cigarettes or, you know, the dangers of vaping or the dangers of automobile reliance or obesity or diabetes, you know, these chronic conditions, unlike so many of these other large social issues, there is a pretty robust conversation going on around AI because it has exploded into everyone's lives in such a public way that people can experience on a day-to-day personal basis. And I think that's at least the beginning of an exciting conversation around this. And that, coupled with the extraordinary potential which this offers, is fundamentally exciting because one way or another, we're going to have a forcing moment in the next decade or so between climate, economic failure, state collapse, large-scale populist movements, and even potentially revolution, and the absolute destruction of much of the labor force by AI, right? That's going to force us to fundamentally reevaluate what we mean for as a society. What does economy mean? What does society mean? What is the world that we actually want to build in here? And that conversation is going to probably be violent. It's probably going to be uncomfortable. It's going to have different forms in different countries, but it's going to become the genesis of what the next couple versions or iterations of human society look like through a decade or two of experimentation and discord and strife, right? And that's freaking exciting because the world is falling apart and we need to start building a new world.
I can't wait. And I'm also thinking of the privilege that people like you and I have to be the ones who can lead and convene and take part in that conversation instead of just being washed back and forth by the consequences of it.
Absolutely. But, you know, one of the things that obviously we're extraordinarily privileged to be able to think about these things and talk about these things. But one of the things that encourages me, I mean, I still live in Dubai, and Dubai is the crossroads of human civilization. There are more expats who weren't born in the UAE living in Dubai than any other city in the world, right? And you have these conversations in coffee shops, at the market, in your office, with so many different people, and people from all walks of life are engaging with this. And I tell you, the people who I've found who are most excited by this are people coming from developing contexts, right? This is South Asia, this is East Asia, this is North Africa. Why? Because these are the people who have historically been screwed out of benefits of the 20th century globalized project. They've been the one on the receiving end of the extractive mechanism. And now suddenly, at least for the moment, there's the glimmer of hope, the possibility that that system is falling apart. Cracks in the world order are emerging, and we have at our fingertips these extraordinarily generative tools to try to build new businesses and build new companies and societies and new ways of doing things. And people are excited, right? Like, talk to an 18-year-old.
That's so interesting that they are seeing the opportunity and the excitement in this. That kind of gives me hope as well.
Absolutely. Talk to a 14-year-old Indian kid about this in Bangalore. They are losing their mind with the potential for this, right? It's incredible. I was having a conversation with a Ghanaian friend recently, and the potential for AI and all the tools which represent in that kind of larger space has for basically dysfunctional failed states and second order semi-functional states, which is most of the world in some argument, right, is absolutely huge. And so there shouldn't be a sort of sense of privilege guilt around talking about this stuff because we're not the only ones talking about it. And in fact, we're probably the ones who are most modestly using this. There's a lot of weird experiments going on in the shadows that are going to define what the tomorrow looks like.
So Dubai has been home for you for...
That's 13, 14 years.
Right. And you spent a lot of that period working as the chief futurist for the government of Dubai. And Dubai is a place that makes, you know, some people in the West kind of uncomfortable. It's not a democratic government. It's kind of not an egalitarian place, very advanced in things like surveillance tech. Why did you spend so long there and what did you learn from it? Why is Dubai so important to you?
It's such a good question because Dubai is one of those things which is means so many different things to so many different people, depending on the eyes through which you look at it. And I think that it's quite typical, certainly, if you've never been there, if you just read about it in the press, particularly if you grew up in the West, Western Europe, UK, France, United States, that you get a particularly filtered version of this. When I first moved there, working in the Prime Minister's office, the thing that was just so profoundly shocking and surprising and invigorating to me was that it was, like I say, it was globalization with the wool pulled off your eyes. It was this huge transit hub of ideas, of people, of attitudes, of beliefs, of goods, of services from literally almost every country in the world, living together, working together, trading together, without the pretense and the intermediation that we normally experience each other through. You know, most of us don't spend a lot of time in India or China or at North Africa or Russia or Ukraine or even other states in America, right? And so in that sense, it gives you this extraordinary vantage point to see how, literally, like I'll give you an example, like one of the things which I gained a tiny degree of notoriety for in my job was like I predicted COVID early, right? And it's not because I'm really smart or I have some vast surveillance apparatus around me or something of that nature. It's because I live in Dubai and there's 2/3 of the world's population within an 8-hour flight there, and almost all economic activity in the region comes through Dubai. I have lots of friends in Singapore. I have lots of friends in China. I have lots of friends in India. And I'm in touch with them on a relatively frequent basis. So when things started unfolding in Wuhan and in China with COVID in, you know, end of December, beginning of January, it didn't take a genius to figure out how many flights a day are there between China and the UAE and to think that this is something which could really break.
Right. And that's something that you could just see from where you sat.
Precisely.
Basically.
Precisely. And so I think that's what's so extraordinary about Dubai is it really is a city of the future in the sense that because it is the epicenter of all of these different threads of human civilization and of economy and politics and ideology and belief and culture, everything is kind of there.
Would you argue that Dubai is actually doing a better job of developing this technology in a way that is attentive to ethics and to social needs?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely would. I think there's a dozen examples. I mean, we could take cryptocurrency and blockchain as an example. Early on, we started working in that space in 2014. We created a industry and a civil society group called the Dubai Global Blockchain Council in 2014 that had all the big banks, all the big regulators, all the big tech companies, a bunch of the most interesting startups at the time, as well as a bunch of academics and entrepreneurs in it. And what did we do? We just first started talking about it. What do we mean by this? What is this thing, right? This was a big collaborative civil society effort. And we did a bunch of public events, started having conversations with the media about it, building a dialogue around this in the public sphere. And then after kind of coming up with some understanding of what the risks and the opportunities were, each of the people in the organization in the industry association started to do experiments and prototypes, and proof of concepts. What does it mean for a bank? What does it mean for a logistics company? What does it mean for a car company? What does it mean for education certification and degrees and for the healthcare authority? And by doing these little experiments, we were able to do several things at once, which was first, remove the emotional terror from the novelty of this new way of doing things, which is the biggest barrier to change. And second, provide strong coalitions of people who supported it in the industry, who had skin in the game and who were willing to test it out, that led to not only the legalization of crypto in 2016, but also a very ambitious strategy to implement cryptocurrency technologies in all of the public sector applications. And, you know, I think the U.S. is still arguing over how to regulate this stuff.
What's been your best call and your worst call about the future?
I think COVID was a great call, you know, called that early.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped going to work 2 months before it became a commonly accepted thing. When I had to go into work, I was wearing masks and everyone was yelling at me like, you're freaking people out. Why are you doing this? Stop this. Our staff is getting scared. We don't have an official statement out yet. But I said, no, this is a big deal. This is coming. And in fact, you know, my COVID escape story was like a scene from the movie Children of Men. You know, I escaped Dubai 2 days before the border closed. I arrived in the UK to pick up my kids and family. Managed to convince them in a 48-hour period that this was a really big deal. We rented a car, drove through the Channel to France, the 2 hours before the borders closed, found a place to stay 2 hours before the national lockdown in France occurred, and spent 4 months in an organic pig farm in Haute-Provence. And it was
that sounds
awesome.
Like a good call.
It was awesome. So like that was definitely probably my shining moment as an applied futurist there.
And as a father.
And as a father, yeah. So, I mean, like, that was the moment where all those years of conversation were like, we might be refugees, guys. Things might change really surprising in dramatic ways really fast. All that stuff paid off.
And what was your worst call?
What was my worst call? I'd have to say self-driving cars.
What did you say about them?
Well, I was big on autonomous transport quite early. And, you know, part of my background is as an urban planner. And I took one of the first delegations of all senior Dubai government officials to San Francisco back in like 2014 or so, 2014, 15. You know, we visited Google X before it was Waymo and, you know, a lot of these self-driving car companies then. And it looked to me that the development curve of AI and computer vision and autonomy was going to yield pretty dramatic changes in the mobility space over the next 5-10 years. And, you know, when you're talking about road building programs, that means you have to start changing the way you're doing things now. So we went really big on self-driving cars and autonomous transport and developed a big autonomous transport strategy. And just the industry hasn't really gotten there.
What keeps you up at night?
Well, we certainly have not seen the last pandemic, that's for sure. You know, I was reading a study the other day by a development institute. They were estimating something like a 25% chance of another corona scale pandemic within the next 10 years and a 50% chance within the next 20 years. You know, that's just one of those things that is so far beyond our control that we have really not prepared for, that would really, really ruin a lot of people's days. So I'm really worried about that. I'm still worried about uncontrolled nuclear releases. You know, I'm really worried. Actually, speaking about the pandemic thing, I'm really worried a lot of the evidence I'm seeing coming out of the Siberian tundra that's thawing. You know, there's all sorts of unbelievably nasty viruses from 15,000 years ago, like new strains of anthrax and stuff, which have been lying dormant in the Siberian tundra, which are just going to get released over the next decade or two. And we have...
You started talking about the tundra, and I thought you were going to say methane.
Yeah, I wish. I wish methane was... Methane's a long, slow problem for us. But we are likely to face some emerging infectious disease or virus coming out of melted tundra in Siberia sooner rather than later. And we have no idea what that looks like. And all the biologists, which I've been reading around the space, are pretty freaking terrified about it.
Okay. And then finally, what gives you cause for optimism?
I mean, it's exciting, right? It's exciting. Like, I just started my own company, an AI company, which is super exciting to be able to have, you know, really the power of billions of dollars of computational data analysis at your hands for pennies, you know, and to be able to build niche services around that, build like really valuable companies around little niches that serve a specific audience really, really well. It's so exciting, right? There's so many life-changing amounts of money and life-changing businesses which are going to be made in the next 2-3 years around AI by itself, right? That that it should give people hope. Right. It should give people some immediate day-to-day sense of encouragement and enthusiasm that we can actually do something that is definitely going to change our lives and our families' lives, if not, quote unquote, save the world. But, you know, net at a whole, so many people are experimenting in these spaces, be it from biotech to new financial services to new applications of AI, that it's just deeply exciting.
Noah, you are one of the people that I know that most lives in the future, and I'm going to sign off by telling you to have a nice future, because I'm pretty sure you're going to have one.
Let's have a nice future together.
Thank you, Noah.
Thanks, Gideon.
Hackers and cybercriminals have always held this kind of special fascination.
Obviously, I can't tell you too much about what I do.
It's a game. Who's the best hacker? And I was like, well, this is child's play.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston, and on the Click Here podcast, you'll meet them and the people trying to stop them.
We're not afraid of the attack. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
Click Here, stories about the people making and breaking our digital world.
AI machine.
Satellite. Engine ignition.
Click Here.
And liftoff.
Click Here, every Tuesday and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, how did that make you feel, Lauren?
Well, let me just say, I would love to be a fly on the wall during one of Noah Rafford's dinner conversations with his kids.
Right. The ones where he says, you're going to be refugees.
Yes. Every 6 months or so, just, you know, call for the family meeting and say, kids, we're preparing for the worst. I can't tell whether that instills unnecessary fear in future generations or whether that's actually the smart thing to do. It seems like it's a pretty smart thing to do.
It seems like a smart thing to do to me. I mean, we're afraid of, we can't imagine conversations like that because we're precisely afraid of that possibility. Could you imagine becoming a refugee? But people have grown up in all sorts of different times of history with all kinds of different expectations about what the future is or even the concept of the future. So I feel like if you get people used to the fact that it's going to look or could look a certain way, then maybe it's a lot less traumatic when it finally happens.
Right. And it made me think also, based on what he said about pandemics, that maybe we should be having those conversations once every 3 to 6 months amongst ourselves to say, how are we going to handle it if or when the next pandemic happens?
Right. It's, you know, I mean, it's almost like being preppers in the US, people who are just expecting the worst and are ready for it to happen. It's, you know, it's easy to laugh at them, but then there is something about that feeling of feeling ready, feeling secure, that even if the worst happens, you can handle it. I think that might be psychologically helpful to a lot of people, especially in the world we're going into.
The second thing that came to mind was I wasn't sure what to make of his approach to thinking about climate change. And I wanted to hear your thoughts on this, because on the one hand, he's saying we should do small things in order to feel a sense of agency. But on the other hand, he basically says that what we do does not matter. We could recycle all the stuff we're supposed to recycle. We could bike to work, as I've started doing, and it just doesn't matter. That was a little bit depressing to hear, right? Because this recent IPCC report makes it clear just how dire things are and that we really need swift, wide-scale reduction in the use of fossil fuels if we're going to avoid reaching catastrophic global temperatures. And yet Noah is saying it doesn't matter. Everything we do doesn't matter.
I mean, I think...
How did you square this?
I think the way I took it was he was saying, yes, individual actions like, you know, biking to work one day or recycling the throttle are not going to make a difference. But I think if we are doing these things, taking responsibility for the way our actions might impact the climate, then two things happen. One, you get a sense of agency that I think is just good for your mental well-being. And two, you become part of this fabric of people who are taking these actions, thinking about these things, and making the question of climate more central in their lives just by virtue of action. And I think it influences the decisions that we make around which politicians we support or which campaigns we support or which companies we buy from. And mm-hmm. those decisions ultimately influence the people whose decisions do matter, because those are the big policy and commercial decisions that ultimately change the course of what fuels we use or what energy gets expended.
And here's the other thing that you guys talked about that really stood out to me, AI, right? And I thought he really helped put this in perspective for me, because we as journalists are a little bit alarmed right now by the release of generative AI, and I think we should be. But Noah also brought up a fair point about how there may be a 14-year-old kid in another part of the world, I mean, he mentions Bangalore specifically, that is seeing generative AI as a tool or as an opportunity, and that some of the technological developments of the past 20 years may have left large portions of the population behind, right? And this is a chance for people to actually sort of get on even ground. At the same time, I'm not entirely convinced that generative AI will be any different from those advancements, because we're already seeing how it's being released within a sort of capitalistic structure and how people are being used as inputs for the training data. What did you make of that?
You know, of course there are going to be the 14-year-olds in Bangalore who will be able to have opportunities they wouldn't have had otherwise because of generative AI. For me, there's always this quote that sticks in my mind from Zeynep Tufekci, who's a sociologist of technology, in a piece that she wrote that I commissioned. And it is, power always learns and powerful tools always fall into its hands. And the point that she's making is, you know, the structural, political, economic power arrangements that exist tend to reassert themselves. And they are slower to catch up to new technologies, but they ultimately do catch up. So I am skeptical that these tools are going to fundamentally create a more level playing field. They will give opportunities to some.
Say a little bit more about that.
I mean that we will see the kid from Bangalore become the leader of a multi-billion dollar company. And in fact, that's already happened with some of the top companies in the US. But those power structures that they come into are existing power structures. So You know, is India going to overtake the US because of generative AI? No. Is India going to overtake the US for other reasons? Possibly. But I don't think technology is the driving force there. It's demographic questions, it's economic questions, it's geopolitical questions that are driving who ultimately ends up on top.
Yeah, and especially since these generative AI tools are coming from these capitalistic enterprises. There are roots in academic research, but right now it's kind of a race amongst these companies, these tech companies, to just put things out into the world and like best each other.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to bode super well for us as humans. We're all humans, but that doesn't seem to bode super well for us as, you know, the average tech consumers.
You know, one of the things that for me was interesting was how he talked about the UAE as this transit hub for people all over the world. I think a lot about the future of government and democracy. And one of the things that's clear is that the notion that I grew up with, that liberal democracy is just going to take over the entire world, that's not going to happen. And what Noah was hinting at for me was a future in which there are many different kinds of government systems around the world. And it's not necessarily obvious that the democracies are the ones that are best at serving their citizens or at keeping up with the pace of technological development and how to regulate it. I think he described how he felt like Dubai is much more on top of the pace of technological change and how to keep it doing the best things for its society. So I feel like that's an uncomfortable position for us in the Western world because we grew up with this notion that our political system is necessarily going to yield the best results, the most equal results for everybody. And Noah got me thinking a lot about just how true or untrue that is.
How hopeful did you feel walking away from your conversation with him?
I felt more hopeful simply because I saw from him that there is a way to think about the future that doesn't require you to feel like you have to be able to predict the future. It's more about a mindset of preparedness for it. Now, sure, that I think that also comes with a certain amount of privilege that someone like Noah has or someone like you or I have, that we're in a good position to be able to capitalize on wherever the future is going and be prepared for it. That isn't true of everyone. But at least it gave me some reassurance that you don't have to know where things are going in order to survive them.
So it's not like he told you we're going to have a nice future, but he told you we can at least be prepared for a not nice future?
Yeah.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Have a Nice Future is hosted by me, Lauren Good.
And me, Gideon Litchfield.
If you like the show, you can leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts and follow us to hear more episodes.
Have a Nice Future is a production of Condé Nast Entertainment. Danielle Hewitt and Lena Richards from Prologue Projects produce the show.
See you back here next Wednesday.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.